Major funding for Backstory is provided by an anonymous donor, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation.
From Virginia Humanities, this is Backstory.
Welcome to Backstory, the show that explains the history behind today's headlines. I'm Brian Ballow.
And I'm Joanne Freeman. If you're new to the podcast, we're all historians. And along with Ed Ayers and Nathan Connolly, each week we explore a different aspect of American history.
I'll bet you didn't know that exactly 227 years ago, on April 5th, 1792, George Washington issued the first veto in American history. Washington might have been the first president to use a veto, but he certainly wasn't the last. Later, we'll learn which president used the power more than any other. And we'll discuss President Trump, who issued his first veto a few weeks ago. So today on the show, we explore presidential vetoes throughout American history.
Today, we think of the president's ability to veto legislation as part of a kind of perpetual power play, a tug of war between the executive and legislative branches. But during his presidency, which, of course, was the first presidency, George Washington wasn't exactly chomping at the bit to veto legislation. That is, until a controversial bill came across his desk.
So not only was the bill messy, it was very unclear and struck people as sort of secretive. And it seemed to favor the northern states a little bit more. And so that was obviously very problematic.
That's historian Lindsay Chervinsky describing the first vetoed piece of legislation in American history. The bill proposed a formula to calculate how many House representatives were to be assigned to each state. But before Washington passed judgment on the bill, he consulted with his cabinet.
Secretary of Treasury Alexander Hamilton and Secretary of War Henry Knox favored the bill, and Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson and Attorney General Edmund Randolph opposed the bill. And so Washington, very interestingly, asked them all for written opinions about what he should do in the first week of April before issuing the veto. And I say interestingly because he had convened a cabinet meeting by this point. The first cabinet meeting took place on November 26, 1791. And so there was precedent for meeting in person. And instead, he decided to request written opinions, even though they were all in town, which I think says a lot about how he wanted to contemplate their decisions slowly and make a decision sort of in his own time. But also, if he was going to issue a veto, that was going to be a huge precedent that he was setting. And maybe, I mean, we don't know because he didn't write this down. He often didn't write down his thought process. But maybe he wanted to make sure he had written evidence of support for a veto if he decided to go that route.
Which would be a very savvy political thing to do if you're George Washington.
Yes, and he never published any of those types of opinions or reports, but I do think it was definitely the back of his mind. He was way more politically savvy than people give him credit for.
Jefferson really seized hold of this. What's your sense of why he grabbed hold of this as being so important?
Well, I think there were a couple of reasons. I think that he felt that the Constitution actually was much more explicit than people were giving it credit for. And so he felt that the Constitution was very explicit and you needed to have the strict reading of the Constitution. So I think it's part of a broader sort of ideological view of the way the Constitution needs to be read. I think part of it is he also felt like it really advantaged states like Massachusetts and Vermont and some states.
That was going to be my question. He's a Southerner, so some part of him is responding like a Southerner.
Absolutely. And then I think he also realized that Washington was uncomfortable with the bill, but he was very worried about appearing to favor the southern states, especially Virginia. He didn't want to appear to be giving any sort of favoritism. And so he needed, Washington needed all of the ammunition he could possibly get to come up with a really solid reason to use the veto. And lastly, I think that Jefferson recognized the importance of Washington's precedent, and the veto was a really important part of the executive branch, and that at some point it needed to be used before Washington left office. And, you know, by this point, it's 1792, Jefferson is already thinking about when he's going to retire, and he doesn't end up doing so for a while, but if he, you know, he might have been thinking in his mind, if I'm going to leave office soon, I want to make sure he uses it before I leave. Of course, I'm speculating on that because he didn't write that down. But if we look at sort of the timeline of when he starts talking about retirement, it's in 1792. So that might have also been at the back of his mind.
And, you know, as you're just suggesting there, one of the really interesting things about this entire period, but particularly this first term, is that almost everything Washington does sets a precedent. Because there is no such thing as a president. And so, you know, until there is one in the Constitution based on this new Constitution that's gone into effect. So he's constantly setting precedents. And so in that sense, and as you just suggested about Jefferson, right, there's a constitutional interpretive component here where people understand that it isn't just about this one bill, but it's about something much broader, about the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And it's also about something much broader, meaning that some kind of precedent has to be set. And to me, that's really intriguing, this idea that if he doesn't do it, other politicians, other presidents who follow him might be unwilling to do it. I assume because if the great Washington did not use the veto, who else has a right to use a veto? So, you know, there's a reason for it that actually isn't really related to the bill itself.
Exactly, exactly. And I always stress to students and to other people when I'm talking about this period that the Constitution itself is actually pretty brief, and so few of the details are actually fleshed out, especially in Article 2, which deals with the presidency. And all of those fuzzy details about what day-to-day governing would look like, Washington really had to figure out, and he knew how much pressure was on every single decision, and at one point mentioned to a friend that he felt before going to office like he was a prisoner going to the site of execution because there was just so much pressure, and if he failed, the government would fail. I really believe that, and I think that he really believed it. And so it's not just a matter of, you know, trying to make the best decision. It's making the best decision that's going to guide every single person that comes after you.
And in that same context, a veto, a presidential veto, is a dramatic act. It's a blunt assertion of executive power.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, even the concept of, like, how do you go about doing that was unknown. So once he sort of decides that, okay, I think I favor this, but I'm really worried about how it's going to look, he asks Jefferson and Randolph to go meet with Madison. Which is interesting because at this point, he isn't as close with Madison as he had been in 1789 and 1790.
And for our listeners, Madison is in the House.
Yes, James Madison is in the House. He's sort of the unspoken leader of what is becoming this sort of nascent opposition movement. And he and Washington had really sort of broken their relationship on a lot of different issues where they really felt differently about much of Hamilton's legislation. And so Madison and Washington really weren't as close, and yet he asked Jefferson and Randolph to go meet with Madison. And if Madison agreed with their interpretation, he said, I'm willing to do the veto. Can you please work with Madison to draw up basically an article of veto, because it had never been done before? So he didn't even know what he was supposed to say. He didn't even know how he was supposed to veto this bill. And so they had to come up with this statement to deliver to Congress from scratch.
So what does Washington do? How does he make that final decision? What do you know about the end result of this first veto?
Jefferson and Randolph go to Madison. Madison obviously agrees with them. I'm not sure that there was really any doubt in any of their minds that that was going to happen. And they draw up this veto document. Washington sends it to Congress. In the veto document, he explains why he has a problem with this bill, what the issues are. And based on those recommendations, Congress passes new legislation on April 14th, which, so less than 10 days later, they pass new legislation, which is, you know, crazy if you think about the speed of how Congress usually works. And they pass the new bill. And by and large, it seems like there wasn't much public blowback about it because there had been so much conflict initially about how the first census should be done. So there were so many people that were already willing to support the bill. And then once he came out, you know, and said, I really think this is how it should be done, they immediately adopted those recommendations and just kind of moved forward.
But, you know, it's striking because a presidential veto, in a sense, is a dramatic act, right? It's an assertion of power, a really clear assertion of power. And it sounds like in the case of this first one, that wasn't an enormous part of what was going on in the discussion.
That's right. And I think part of that is how the veto was initially conceived of. And a lot of that goes back to how they initially conceived of the different branches. So I think there was a lot of concern that the legislature was going to be way too powerful. That was certainly Madison's biggest concern. And so the veto was not so much given to assert presidential authority so much as to protect the independence of the executive branch and to protect the president from the legislature. And so the idea was not so much that it was going to claim land or, you know, jurisdiction or power, but to sort of keep the legislature off of the president's front grass, so to speak. And so I think that they were still thinking of the veto in that context. And so in this sense, it didn't seem like this huge assertion of presidential authority. It just seemed like Washington was saying, hey, I don't think you did this right. Try again. Congress was very split on this bill. It barely passed. And so when Washington vetoed it, he wasn't saying, you guys can't do this. He was just saying, I think this is a better way that's more constitutional and more fair. And because so many people already thought that, it was pretty easy to use Washington's authority to get enough other people sort of to hop over the fence and agree with them. And so they were able to pass the new bill really easily.
So it wasn't the equivalent of a fist on the table, right? Washington wasn't banging his fist on the table and saying, no, you shall not do that. But really, as you're suggesting, he was acting as a check and saying, I don't know if this is fair. Do it again.
Yeah, it was more like red pen margin edits than like an F, a failing of an exam. It's more like, here are some suggestions to make it better. Please, you know, redo and turn in again.
Beyond the moment when the decision is made, do you think there's a broader significance for this veto? I mean, is it setting broader precedents that play out in other ways down the road?
I think so. I think there are a couple. I mean, the fact that a veto was used at all, I think Jefferson's concern about had Washington not used it, I think that was very, very smart. And I think that there are certain ceremonial aspects of the government that have evolved and changed a lot in, you know, the last 200 so years. And it's possible that the veto could have become one of those little things that we now think is quaint if Washington hadn't used it. So I think, you know, putting it on the table as an option was really, really important.
So in a sense, when you look at this moment and that when you look at this particular period in government generally, I think part of what we're saying here is it's really easy to underestimate the significance of some of what's going on in this period because things look less institutionalized, because they look more, in a sense, informal and information. And so here's an example of something that ends up being an important precedent, but it's very easy to overlook it because it just seems like in this sort of weird fluid period, something that happened.
Actually, it's one of the things that I find the most fascinating about the early republic is that when we're looking at politics and we're looking at the government, because it was so small and so much had sort of yet to be decided, individuals had such tremendous impact in a way that I don't think has ever really been rivaled.
Lindsay Chervinsky is a historian at the White House Historical Association.
Washington's first presidential veto created a powerful weapon in the commander-in-chief's armory. And it's one that has been in the news lately because President Trump just issued his first presidential veto.
Yes, indeed, Brian. And it's all part of the push and pull surrounding funding for the border wall.
I wanted to know where President Trump's veto fits into the big picture of presidential vetoes throughout the 20th century and beyond. So I got in touch with Jeffrey Engel. He's director of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University in Dallas. I started by asking Jeff what presidents have to consider as they wrestle with the question, to veto or not to veto.
There's actually, I think, two fundamental tracks that you have to think of, and then other questions spin off from there. The first is the question of, do I not like this legislation because I believe it violates the Constitution or because I don't like the politics? Hmm. And we've seen lots of cases, to be honest, more in the 19th century, but some in the 20th, in which the president says, I don't believe that Congress is reading the Constitution correctly, and I have the authority to make them think about it again or really decide right. if they want to do this. That's sort of level A, and that's rare. Level B, question B, is am I doing this for political reasons? As I say, I disagree with the policy. And then it gets really tricky because the president at that point has to go through essentially a logic chain where he asks him or herself, if I say no to this, will it get overridden? Mm-hmm. Is my congressional support strong enough to back me? And of course, if it's strong enough to back me, why did they send me this legislation in the first place? And I think, frankly, the president ultimately has to decide why Congress is sending him or her something that could be vetoable.
Right.
Because one of the things that's really fascinating is that, you know, we focus on the big cases, you know, the exciting constitutional dramas where the president and the Congress are pitted against each other over big ideals. The truth is the majority of vetoes in the 20th century are essentially Congress passing something they really don't want to, and they know the president will veto. And that way they can go to their constituents and say, hey, we did our part. And if that's the case, and the president would know that, he can pocket veto it or he can just decide that he wants to reject it out of hand and everybody walks away happy.
So tell us what some of the most important, the most notable or most notorious presidential vetoes have been over the last century.
Some of the most famous cases, for example, are, you know, Ronald Reagan's decision to veto sanctions against the apartheid-led government of South Africa uh-huh. in the mid-1980s. And that was a really interesting and difficult decision and controversy because, obviously, apartheid was not only unpopular in the United States, it had become, in many ways, a cause célèbre among people in the United States. And the opposition within the United States and the world community, but America in particular, was growing on a weekly basis as more and more people realized either A, apartheid was terrible, or B, I should say apartheid is terrible because that's good politics for me, even if I'm not concerned with it. And ultimately, there builds a momentum in Congress for mass sanctions against South Africa beyond even the sanctions that the United States had already imposed. And Ronald Reagan, who frankly was interested in keeping good relations with South Africa for geopolitical reasons, and also, I would say, had never made African-American civil rights one of his, which of course was a group that was concerned with the South Africa issue, he'd never made African-American civil rights one of his primary issues. So he argued that the sanctions that Congress was imposing on South Africa were far too sweeping, far too broad.
And now we've reached a critical juncture. Many in Congress and some in Europe are clamoring for sweeping sanctions against South Africa. The Prime Minister of Great Britain has denounced punitive sanctions as immoral and utterly repugnant. Well, let me tell you why we believe Mrs. Thatcher is right. The primary victims of an economic boycott of South Africa would be the very people we seek to help. Most of the workers who would lose jobs because of sanctions would be black workers.
This, despite the fact that leaders throughout South Africa, Desmond Tutu, for example, the most famously, begged him to impose these sanctions, recognizing that, yes, we will suffer, but the whole country needs to suffer if we're going to make the government change. Ultimately, Reagan, therefore, vetoes a sanctions bill in order to say, I want different kinds of sanctions. And the fascinating thing about that is that nobody realized that's what the argument was about in the regular media. That is to say, people in Washington knew that this was a debate in essence over what type of sanctions we want to have. Throughout the country, it was understood as a debate over whether or not Ronald Reagan is a racist, which is to say, perhaps he doesn't care about South Africa and apartheid. And it was a wonderful, from a historian perspective, wonderful example of how the large public broad discussion was completely divorced from the actual policy at hand, even though it was one of the biggest policy discussions of the day.
And what was the ultimate outcome? Did he get a more tailored sanctions bill?
No. As a matter of fact, his veto was overridden.
Yep.
And so consequently, Congress got its way on that one. And, you know, in many ways, that allowed them to everybody to turn around happy again. So Ronald Reagan was able to say on a political level, and more importantly, on an international diplomatic level, listen, I did my best for what I thought was good policy.
Right. I went to the mats. What can I do if Congress is going to override me?
This is all I got. And, you know, the argument that my hands are tied doesn't always sound and resonate well overseas when a president offers that, because the president of the United States is the most powerful person in the world.
Right.
But this is a case where the president can actually point to the Constitution and which line of the Constitution says, here's where it says my hands are tied. So that's a much more powerful argument for him overseas. And Congress got the sanctions it desired.
If you look back, and you don't have to look back that far, vetoes used to be a lot more common. I think FDR is the kind of world champ. I mean, yes, he served four terms or almost four complete terms, but he's got hundreds and hundreds of vetoes to his credit.
600, yeah.
600. So what's the deal there? And if I don't have my history wrong, he had a Democratic Congress for a lot of the time.
Exactly. I mean, you know, so we naturally think that the president's going to have more vetoes when the other party controls Congress and therefore they're butting heads. But as you point out, FDR had a Democratic Congress throughout his entire time in office.
Yep.
And what that did in an interesting way was essentially turn the veto into not a way for the president to stop legislation that he didn't like most of the time, but rather to stop legislation, as I mentioned earlier, that everyone didn't like. There were numerous instances where the Congress passed what we would consider to be basically petty resolutions, you know, that this one individual needs compensation or that they need to change the name on a post office, something along those lines. And discussion was held with the Congress that, you know, this will make Congressman Bob happy if we pass this, but we don't really want it. So the president can veto it, and we're all happy in the end.
Well, if you step back a little bit, does the use of vetoes or frequent use of vetoes, does that tell us anything about Roosevelt's attitude towards executive power itself? Or, as you put it, these are kind of trivial things and it's just kind of internal face-saving measures?
You know, Roosevelt is fascinating in the regard that you just mentioned, his view of executive power, because he believed, I think, in expansive federal power. In fact, in his initial inauguration during the height of the Depression, he explains very clearly to the public that he is going to ask Congress for legislation to meet the current crisis, the Depression. But if Congress does not give me what I want, I will ask it then for executive powers, and I will assume executive powers. Basically, you know, if the rest of the world is recognizing in 1933 that some crises are best resolved by having strong men in charge, I'm willing to do that if necessary.
Right.
And throughout his time in office, there were many moments where Franklin Roosevelt essentially made the executive decision to move the country in a direction, even as he's trying to persuade Congress, but before he had actually persuaded it. Sometimes, obviously, that was pushed back by Congress. Most famously, of course, I think in his plan to pack the court, to get more of his allies on the court by expanding the size of the Supreme Court. And then ultimately, I think more importantly, his decision from 1937-38 on to integrate the United States more into the global problems that resulted in World War II and to rearm the country in preparation for that. He did a tremendous amount of executive reach in order to move the country in that direction, despite, if not congressional opposition, then at least congressional ambivalence.
We know that recent presidents, recent being the last 30 or 40 years, used the veto pen a lot less than presidents in the first half of the 20th century. What's going on there?
I think the fundamental reason is because the president is engaged in the discussion process, the formation of legislation, the sausage making, if you will, from the beginning. And therefore, we see fewer and fewer bills get passed by Congress that the president hasn't already signaled that he's going to approve, because his team have been part of the negotiators. And directly connected to that, is the rise of large omnibus bills, that is to say, 75 pieces of legislation within one act, that the president's people with Congress have negotiated all 75, and you're not going to vote on it until you get all 75 approved. So the president may disagree with one, agree with 74. He's not going to get it across his desk till the omnibus bill is passed. And the days when Congress would essentially pass important legislation to make sure that, you know, Mrs. Baker from Smithfield continued to receive her husband's pension, that doesn't go through Congress anymore. And so there's as long as the issues are huge, the chances that the president is going to get a piece of legislation that he dislikes to his desk are increasingly small.
Jeff, does the public have an attitude about the use of a veto generally, or is it always very much connected to the specific legislation that the president is vetoing?
You know, I think the public is really quite satisfied with a president using his or her veto pen because that's a constitution, an easily understood constitutional right mm-hmm. the president has. That's, I think, one of the things that made the recent and ongoing brouhaha over President Trump's initial veto, so the only one of his administration thus far, such a fascinating political Rorschach test. President Trump wanted a border wall. The Congress would not pass legislation that would give him the border wall he wanted, so he declared that he was going to use funds already appropriated by Congress for purposes not appropriated by Congress through his executive authority.
Under his emergency powers.
Yes.
As authorized by congressional legislation, according to Trump.
According to Trump. Well, that's it, according to Trump. And whether or not you agree with the president or not, the fundamental point is that no president has ever done that before. Mm-hmm. No president had ever assumed the authority. And there, Congress came back and voted against the president's use of that executive authority. However, not by two-thirds in the Senate. Therefore, President Trump's use of emergency powers, unprecedented use of emergency powers, stands. Even though the public looks at Congress and says, didn't Congress just vote against that twice? And more importantly, didn't members of the president's own political party come out strongly against his use of executive authority in this way and then wind up voting in favor of his use of executive authority in this way? Those are the kind of cases when the public watches the tennis ball, if you will, being batted back and forth multiple times and people seeming to play on both sides of the tennis court, if you will, that the public does not like, because that's not necessarily a clear use of executive authority. That's, again, to use the phrase, a swampy use of executive authority.
So do you think this decision, even though Trump won this particular legislative battle, at least for now, do you think this will hurt Trump politically?
No, I think it's going to help Trump politically. In fact, this is a great example, I think, of a president using his veto power for personal political gain in many ways, because President Trump clearly wants to run his 2020 campaign with immigration and, let's be clear, being extremely strongly against immigration, especially from the southern parts mm-hmm. of the Western Hemisphere. Mm-hmm. He wants that to be the signature issue. If he actually gets what he wants, which is a huge wall across the southern border, even if Mexico pays for it or not, if he actually gets that, he doesn't have that to campaign on. And so I think the more that he is able to do things that tie up this issue, and more importantly, even better for him, if the courts intervene and rule that his action was unconstitutional.
That's where I was headed. It's almost like a second veto.
Yes, but it's a second veto that the president would welcome, I think, politically in this case. And so if Trump can not only make the argument that the liberals are making you unsafe on the border, but those darn liberal judges are making you unsafe by exerting their own authority to try to curtail my exertion of authority, as long as that issue is one that he can rail on, I think he's a happy camper.
That was Jeffrey Engel. He directs the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University. He's co-author of the book, Impeachment in American History. Joanne, as the Washington Whisperer, tell me what our first president would have thought about the idea of one of his successors, Franklin D. Roosevelt, vetoing 635 pieces of legislation. 635. Count them.
Wow. Washington was unsure about producing one veto. You know, so 635. I mean, but, you know, if you think about the first presidency, I mean, Washington as the first president, he was pretty nervous about really doing anything that was a major assertion of power. There hadn't been a president before. So something that we now take for granted, although maybe not 635 times for granted, but still, you assume that that's a power of the presidency. And Washington did not necessarily assume that that was something that he would be doing during his presidency. One of the things that I always find really moving is actually Washington's copy of the Constitution, because when you see it, it's, I think Mount Vernon owns it. And when you look through it, what he does really carefully, and it's related to this idea of the veto, he goes through and in the margin, wherever the president is responsible for something, he wrote president. So he was really, really carefully delineating, you know, what are the things I'm supposed to
now,
do?
Are you sure he wasn't just rubbing it in, as in, I'm the president? That would be me, now the president.
That would require an exclamation point, I think. President. But you know, he really was thinking about power, right? The presidency, yes. That's the main point of controversy with the presidency, is that it's one person with a potentially enormous amount of power. So how did people respond, Brian, to the 635? I mean, were there people screeching about executive power?
Well, they certainly charged Roosevelt with that, but I'm not sure that the number of vetoes would be at the top of the list compared to, let's say, changing the number of justices on the Supreme Court, increasing it to fit your legislative agenda. And my own sense is that Washington might have been far more appalled that there were 635 pieces of legislation. And that really underscores the kind of legislation that FDR vetoed, which very much comes out of the middle and later parts of the 19th century. And that's, as you know, Joanne, all of those what were called personal bills, legislation that actually had to do with one individual giving them a pension and that kind of thing. So my own guess is that Washington might have been much more appalled by that than the number of vetoes. Roosevelt viewed the presidency very different. And of course, he lived in a very different time. And here's where the international context may tell us a lot. I mean, let's think about some of the leaders of other countries at the time that Roosevelt was president. Let's see. We've got Hitler. We've got Mussolini. We've got Stalin. I mean, Roosevelt very much viewed himself as surrounded by strongmen who could do what they wanted, do it quickly, and not do it with a lot of back and forth in conversation. And it was only shortly after Franklin Roosevelt's death and after World War II that Congress was labeled a horse and buggy institution in the atomic age, right? Mm. And so there was a strong feeling throughout the 20th century, really starting with Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson. It wasn't just Franklin Roosevelt that, you know, this Congress thing, this deliberation thing, this debate thing, this openness thing, that might not work so well in the 20th century.
Interesting. Because at the beginning of the government, what they were worried about more than anything else, of course, was power. Was, you know, a channel of power seemingly issuing from one person. I mean, it's why they debated, at least for a while at the Constitutional Convention, having some kind of a panel of executives and not one particular person, because they were so worried about the precise thing that you're saying, in a sense, is necessary in the 20th century.
Let's turn to the 21st century. Mm. I'd love to hear your thoughts about President Trump's first use of a veto. What would George Washington have thought about Well, I don't know what he would have thought about the wall, but what would he have thought about the extension of emergency powers to, in essence, reverse congressional appropriations?
Wow. That there is a question I never imagined being asked.
Well, neither did George, so this is perfect. Yeah,
that's true. Well, you know, on the one hand, I think Washington and any number of other individuals would be stunned at that kind of assertion of power. Interestingly, probably another aspect of the veto that Washington would have picked up on is the fact that it got so much public attention. Washington was extremely sensitive to how the public was viewing his actions and his assertions of power or lack of assertions of power. And so in a sense, he might have felt some empathy towards someone making an assertion as much as he might not like it and seeing the public so engaged in responding to it.
I have a bonus question for you.
Oh, no. Okay.
Did Washington sign the first veto with a Sharpie?
I can definitively say no.
Thank you, Joanne.
Well, so I'm going to turn this now back on you, Brian. You made me compare Washington and Trump. So how might FDR see similarities or differences between the situation he was engaged with and what we're seeing now with President Trump?
Well, I think one similarity, Joanne, is like FDR, Trump not only sees strongmen around the world, frankly, he's quite attracted to them. Pundits have talked about his bromance with some of them. Mm. Now, of course, he has many options to choose from. It's not so long ago that we were talking about democracy breaking out in the Middle East and democracy breaking out around the world. The difference between Trump and Franklin D. Roosevelt is that I think Trump is trying to be more like these strongmen, and Roosevelt was trying to figure out a way to save constitutional governance in a world where strongmen could operate pretty swiftly, pretty quickly, without public consent. He was trying genuinely to thread a needle.
That's it for us today. But you can keep the conversation going online. Let us know what you thought of the episode or ask us your questions about history. You'll find us at backstoryradio.org or send an email to backstory@virginia.edu. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Backstory Radio. Whatever you do, don't be a stranger.
Backstory is produced at Virginia Humanities. Major support is provided by an anonymous donor, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Provost's Office at the University of Virginia, the Johns Hopkins University, the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation, and the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations. Additional support is provided by the Tomato Fund, cultivating fresh ideas in the arts, the humanities, and the environment.
Brian Ballow is Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Ed Ayers is Professor of the Humanities and President Emeritus of the University of Richmond. Joanne Freeman is Professor of History and American Studies at Yale University. Nathan Connolly is the Herbert Baxter Adams Associate Professor of History at the Johns Hopkins University. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for Virginia Humanities.